So good afternoon. I'd like to welcome our members and guests to the 480th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue central to U.S. foreign policy. And this month, we are pleased to have Dr. Martin Mulesen here to speak on the IMF and World Bank in the new geopolitical environment. Dr. Mulesen is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center and a former International Monetary Fund official with decades-long experience in economic crisis management and financial diplomacy. Among his other responsibilities as the IMF's Director for Strategy, Policy, and Review, Dr. Mulesen led the IMF's response to the COVID-19 crisis and oversaw work on the institution's overall strategy and lending policies. He represented the International Monetary Fund in Group of Seven and Group of 20, G7 and G20 communique sessions, participating in six leaders' summits. He also played a leading role in the negotiations extending the IMF's special drawing rights allocation, the new arrangement to borrow, and the G20's Debt Service Suspension Initiative and Common Framework for Debt Relief. Dr. Mulesen served in several roles at the IMF, including Chief of Staff and Principal Advisor to Managing Director Christine Lagarde from 2013 to 2017. As an IMF staffer, he worked with several other of the major G20 countries on fiscal and financial policy issues. Dr. Mulesen is a German national and a Konrad Adenauer scholar. He holds a master's degree in economics from Cambridge University and a PhD summa cum laude in economics from the University of Munich. He has published and overseen work on macro financial analysis, the international monetary system, and digital currencies, economic linkages, fiscal policy, and inequality. Martin, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Dear George, President Luc, thank you for your generous introduction, and dear members of the Midcoast Forum. When my wife and I first arrived in the United States more than 30 years ago, one of our first vacation trips brought us all the way from Washington, D.C. up to Maine. We stayed in a little bed and breakfast in Damariscotta, not far from here, and we have since come back to the States with our kids a couple of times. We've always enjoyed Maine's beauty and liked its people. So we didn't have to think twice before accepting your kind invitation to take part in today's meeting. Thank you for giving us the opportunity. I'm honored to contribute to the impressive discussion of foreign policy matters that you had with many illustrious speakers over the years. I understand that many of you have had a distinguished career in government or the private sector, sometimes involving lengthy stays abroad. The knowledge and experience you gained in the process remain highly relevant today, even if the political environment is quite different from what we all experienced during our active time. So you are much better placed to assess what the new tariffs and the administration's America First policy will mean for US relations with other countries, allies and adversaries alike. But perhaps I may be able to shed some light on the international financial system, which has also become an important arena in which the geopolitical rivalry between the United States and China is playing out. And when the global economy is under strain, as it is right now, international finance has a habit of moving to center stage at some point. Let me start by taking you back and talk about the founding of the IMF and World Bank, the so-called Bretton Woods institutions. They were created in 1944 to facilitate the expansion and balanced growth of international trade. Balanced. We'll come back to that. The two institutions, along with other multilateral development banks, have been a valuable tool for US economic statecraft for more than 80 years. But wait, you might think, are these organizations not under the United Nations umbrella? And is the leadership of the IMF not in European hands? Yes, this is true. But there are key distinctions to how the UN is being run. First, the IMF and World Bank aren't governed by a one country, one vote arrangement as in the United Nations. Instead, the share of each member country broadly depends on its weight in the world economy. Unsurprisingly, the United States and other large industrial countries, therefore, hold the lion's share of votes in these institutions. A second difference relates to the veto power for important decisions. In the UN Security Council, the United States shares its veto with four other powers, notably Russia and China. In the IMF and World Bank, the US voting share is such that it is the only country that can block important decisions on its own. Third, the US influence goes well beyond its sheer voting power. In fact, while the original charter of the two institutions was signed by 44 nations, it was the United States that put its stamp on their final architecture. At Bretton Woods, the representative of the United Kingdom, John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, wanted the IMF to become an agency in charge of a supranational currency called the Bancor that would be used to settle international transactions. The Bancor was to be administrated in a way that would make it costly for countries to run either large trade deficits or surpluses. So that's where the balance comes in again. That Bancor proposal was based on the insight that in case of trade imbalances, countries with a trade surplus usually have little incentive to change their policies, placing the need for policy adjustments squarely onto deficit countries. Spreading that adjustment burden more equally is something that many economists still believe would have put the global financial system on a more stable basis back in 1944. In fact, we're still discussing the issue of trade surpluses and deficits to the current day. The other major player, however, at the Bretton Woods conference was Harry Dexter White, a senior US Treasury official who came with a mandate that reflected primarily the interests of the United States. The US didn't want to be tied into the straitjacket of a global currency. It was itself a major exporter at the time, and instead, it suggested for the IMF to supervise a system of fixed exchange rates anchored by a US promise to keep the dollar at a fixed parity to gold. Moreover, the IMF was to help countries maintain their exchange rate parities, if needed, through conditionality-backed emergency loans. These are the famous IMF programs that also still exist today. The World Bank would support the reconstruction and economic development after the war through large-scale project loans. So the US proposal won out in the end, not the least because many countries at the time held reservations against the United Kingdom as a colonial empire. However, reality soon began to differ from what had been agreed. Most importantly, the sovereign interests of the larger member countries quickly prevailed over how the IMF was supposed to be run. As a result, for example, adjustments in exchange rate parities were often negotiated as fait accompli without the IMF even in the room. And the fund's capital also turned out too small for the job it had been given. Moreover, as feared, countries with large trade surpluses didn't agree to change their economic policies. Why would they, right? Reserves are coming in. And foreign exchange restrictions needed to be kept in place, therefore, to prevent other countries from running out of reserves. In short, the post-war financial environment was still a mess. It also didn't help that the United States increasingly pursued inflationary policies to finance the Vietnam War. And eventually, the US realized that its foreign liabilities had become too large compared to the stock of gold at the Federal Reserve, making it all but impossible to maintain the dollar's parity to gold. In characteristic fashion, when Richard Nixon finally took the US off the gold standard in 1971, ending the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates, the IMF's managing director at the time was given only a few hours' notice before the decision was announced to the public. So, was this the end of the IMF and World Bank? Not quite. But it had become clear that the stability of the new system of floating currencies rested on the dominant role of the US dollar. Negotiations about monetary and exchange rate policies were therefore conducted among the large economies themselves, most famously leading to the Plaza and Louvre Accords in the 1980s. In the meantime, there was plenty of other work for the Bretton Woods institutions. Their membership had grown tremendously in the 1950s and 60s. Former colonies and newly independent states had joined the membership, many of them in need of financial assistance, which became a new focus, especially for the World Bank. Unfortunately, the record of the Bretton Woods twins in the developing world has been a rather mixed story. Much good was done, without doubt, and especially some Asian countries achieved a transformation that was accompanied by a formidable rise in living standards. But it has been a struggle for the international community to lift poor countries to a higher growth path. This started with a basic misunderstanding of the capacity of new governments to implement reforms and conduct sound policies. Excessive adjustment demands and insufficient financial support often fed into a deepening cycle of false starts, political strife, high debt, and default. We will see how China exacerbated that conundrum in a minute. In the 1980s, the IMF played a role in the Latin American debt crisis that almost caused the collapse of the overexposed US banking system. Again, the main solution, though, was provided by the US, who used a piece of clever financial engineering, the so-called Brady bonds, to restore investors' trust in the financial system. Only once the banks were secure could the IMF come in to supervise the ensuing macroeconomic adjustment. In the 90s, membership in both institutions grew further after the collapse of communism and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. With the Cold War over, trade and capital controls began to melt away rapidly, and the world saw a major uptick of capital flows and foreign investment. This stimulated growth in recipient countries. It was a great time back in the 80s and 90s, if you remember. But it also brought new challenges, in particular when countries could not live up to over-optimistic growth expectations. The sudden withdrawal of foreign capital could cause them enormous problems. So the 1990s and 2000s, if you remember, became the heydays of so-called emerging market crises, including in Mexico, the Asian tigers, Brazil, Russia, Argentina, later Turkey. While it was primarily the IMF that negotiated programs with these countries, the United States pulled strings in the background, providing co-financing or using its influence to secure outcomes that were in the US interest. What about the large economies, you might ask? Wasn't the UK once in need of an IMF program? Yes, between 1956 and 1977. The UK had 11 programs with the IMF, as did other industrial countries during the 50s and 60s, in what now seems like an eternity ago. However, after the 2008 subprime mortgage debacle that morphed into the global, or rather North American, or North Atlantic, I should say, North Atlantic financial crisis, the IMF was suddenly back in business in Europe. This was not so much because Europe lacked the money to resolve the situation, but some of the richer European countries who had to provide the bulk of financing to fix the crisis and later build up a rescue fund in Europe, at first didn't trust the European Commission to put this money to good use. The IMF, with its crisis experience, was eventually called in as an honest broker. It had to overcome considerable resistance that a US-dominated institution would be involved in resolving an embarrassing problem in the heart of the euro area. Now, the funny thing was, of course, that the voting shares of EU countries accounted for close to 30% of the IMF's total at the time. And Europe was represented by 8 out of 24 directors on the IMF's executive board. The US has 1. But this discrepancy shows how much the Bretton Woods institutions have always been regarded as a tool of US policy. Even the Europeans themselves didn't quite trust it at the beginning. So, after the euro crisis, or actually during the euro crisis and before, there was one large country in Asia that looked with bemusement at the events, believing its time had come to finally regain the stature it felt it deserved on the global stage. In fact, China had played a constructive role during the crisis, stimulating its economy to support the global economy and keeping its exchange rate stable so as not to cause further disruption. In recognition, China received an important voice at the global table when President George W. Bush first invited G20 leaders to Washington in 2008. The G20 henceforth became a steering committee for the work of international institutions, with key decisions being negotiated at recurring meetings of finance ministers and central bank governors. In 2010, the G20 agreed to a major reallocation of votes at the Bretton Woods institutions to the benefit of China and other emerging markets, but leaving the US veto in place. So far, so good. But ever since the ascent of Xi Jinping, China has been on the offensive against the economic dominance of the US and the dollar. For example, China's famous Belt Road Initiative, or BRI, follows a classic blueprint where countries use large foreign exchange reserves to lend money to other countries for infrastructure projects and the like. According to some estimates, the BRI disbursed up to $1 to $3 trillion in loans to low and middle income countries by 2023. $1.3 trillion. Much of this money flowed back to Chinese companies, securing domestic jobs and providing China with access to strategic raw materials and other geopolitical assets. So why a classic blueprint, by the way? Well, in the early 20th century, Germany was keen to build a railway from Berlin to Baghdad, for example, to outcompete the British in the Mediterranean. So kind of some of the same mechanisms involved. Siemens, of course, would do a lot of the jobs at the time. That project didn't work out so well, but I'm sure that foreign service officers everywhere will recognize the underlying principle. And it certainly did work out for China, if you're looking at the diplomatic inroads it made into what is often called the Global South. In the process, however, China also created significant problems. Being new to the official lenders game, it repeated the mistake of burying countries in debt, much as what US banks had done in Latin America, for example. To make it worse, many BRI projects were white elephants to please corrupt regimes without transparency or concerns about good governance. And then China was reluctant to grant debt relief and own up to bad lending decisions. To be fair, China has since cleaned up its act somewhat, but most of its loans are still made on a commercial, not concessional basis. And China threw a big spanner in the works of international finance when it decided not to join the Paris Club of creditor countries about a decade ago. This created major problems for the operations of the IMF and World Bank. For them, the Paris Club was an important counterpart where official creditors would agree on debt treatments that allowed multilateral loans to resume, because you cannot lend to a country that cannot service its debt. As China negotiated its own debt restructurings, which were proceeding very slowly, it stopped new lending in its tracks. Countries like Zambia, for example, had to wait sometimes for years before their debt was resolved and new IMF and World Bank loans could kick in. There is now a G20 process in place that emulates some of the Paris Club's functions, and the pace has picked up. But China's lending has clearly diminished the role of the IMF and World Bank in the developing world, as well as that of other official creditors, including the United States. So, without oversight over global exchange rates, the G20 in charge of the big decisions, and China eating everybody's lunch in the developing world, do we still need the Bretton Woods institutions today? The short answer is yes. Both institutions are still strongly in the interest of the United States, especially as the current administration is willing to rearrange other aspects of the international order. Let's talk about the IMF first. Critics will say that the IMF is of little relevance today, given that most of its activities focus on developing countries. And when COVID hit, wasn't it the Fed and other large central banks that again saved the global economy? All of this is true. Ever since the 2008 crisis, the first line of defense against global financial turmoil has consisted of liquidity operations by the Fed and large central banks, including currency swap lines with a number of important dollar and euro markets. There also now exist regional safety nets in Europe and Southeast Asia that stand ready to support member countries with large emergency loans. However, it is also the case that many large emerging markets are not covered by these safety nets. During COVID, for example, Mexico, Colombia, Chile, and Peru all took advantage of large precautionary credit lines offered by the IMF, which added up to about $100 billion in 2020. And as of 24, the five largest active borrowers from the IMF included Argentina, Ukraine, Egypt, Pakistan, and Ecuador, for a total of around $85 billion. I do not need to tell you that these countries are all of geopolitical importance to the United States, many of them in the Western Hemisphere, where China has recently made large inroads. If not for the IMF, who would be able to provide crisis support to these countries? Also consider the global current environment. After close to a century, we are coming suspiciously close to the Great Depression. Again, tariffs are going up, bilateral negotiations supersede the World Trade Organization, and world stock markets are in turmoil. I'm not predicting another depression. The lessons from that crisis and the many that have followed since are by now well understood. But let us not be too optimistic either. During times of volatility, financial markets have a way of exposing weaknesses in companies, banks, and countries alike. If bilateral tariffs, for example, were to come into full force, it could be well be that emerging markets with export-led growth models might come into the crosshairs of markets, exposing financial difficulties that could create negative spillovers, including for the United States. In a plausible risk scenario, some important US allies or markets for US exporters might require emergency access to hard currencies. To respond to precisely this kind of scenario, the IMF can mobilize up to $1 trillion to shore up foreign exchange reserves and prevent a large and possibly spreading balance of payments crisis. Absent the IMF safety net, most countries would only have two viable alternatives to protect themselves against this type of shock. They would either have to build up foreign exchange reserves in peacetime, which means weaker domestic exchange rates and larger bilateral trade surpluses vis-a-vis the United States, or they would need to seek help from China, which could drive away trade and financial transactions into other currencies, gradually undermining the dominant role of the US dollar. This should make it clear that the IMF is also a major line of defense for the dollar and other strategic interests of the United States. What is even better from a US perspective? The funding for the IMF is cheap. It only involves a swap of foreign exchange reserves, dollars against SDRs, without significant budgetary cost. And most of it comes from other countries. In fact, overall US contributions to the IMF are leveraged by a factor of more than 5 to 1. So, what about the World Bank? Well, if you look at the sheer numbers, multilateral development and national development banks, including the US Development Finance Corporation, are the primary answer that Western democracies have to counter China's lending activities. Multilateral loans still account for more than a third of the $200 billion in long-term debt of low-income countries. China's official claims are less than 10% of that. As I mentioned, most Chinese loans are made on commercial terms these days. However, the issue is not just a question of numbers. It is how to translate financial assistance into tangible geopolitical advantages. So, multilateral lending comes with a lot of restrictions and caveats, unfortunately, requiring a lot of time that impatient rulers of impatient people in the developing world do not have, even if the end product may be superior compared to Chinese financed and executed projects. The good news is that World Bank President Ajay Banga is committed to improving the pace and quality of loan disbursements in line with his mantra of having a better rather than a bigger bank. And a renewed focus on country ownership and private sector investment should translate into faster and more successful projects that can balance out the advantages currently enjoyed by Chinese lenders. Again, the benefits for the United States are clear. By facilitating growth in regions such as Africa and Southeast Asia that still have rapidly growing populations, the World Bank will help create markets that will provide a boost for US exporters and help reduce global trade imbalances. And just as in the case of the IMF, the World Bank does not require much funding to fulfill its main task. Since its creation, the bank has received $29 billion in capital from the US for its main lending arm, which it has since leveraged into nearly $1.5 trillion available for development finance, a more than 50-fold increase. It is therefore not hard to make a case that the IMF and World Bank are working overwhelmingly in the United States' interest. But to continue their job, the institutions will need to remain firmly under the control of the United States and its G7 counterparts. This clearly goes against the interests of China and other emerging markets, who are pressing for a larger voting share at the two institutions. But we should be clear-eyed about the intentions of the Chinese leadership, which itself uses international organizations to gain strategic advantages, for example, in standard-setting agencies within the UN network. Just let us think about what is at stake. The IMF and World Bank provide loans to help countries settle their financial liabilities, primarily in dollars and euros. Giving a major geopolitical opponent a larger say in how loans to obtain these Western currencies should be designed and paid out would be a major geopolitical own goal. Remaining firmly in Western hands, however, the Bretton Woods institutions must show better results in reducing poverty and lifting growth in their client countries. IMF and World Bank staff know how to design economic programs, but to make them work, they need the backing and active support of their largest shareholders, and of the United States in particular. Given tight budget constraints all around, the focus should not be on providing bigger loans to recipient countries. It should lie on incentives to push critical reforms and boost growth prospects in program countries. This could include targeted bilateral financing, trade preferences, private investment, or various kinds of geopolitical support, providing recipient governments with a stronger impetus to meet their program objectives. For example, I understand Treasury Secretary Bessent is in Buenos Aires today to show his support for Argentina's new IMF program that was just announced last Friday, that in the US view could significantly reduce the country's dependency on Chinese support. So, to sum up, the Bretton Woods institutions have been a geopolitical asset for the United States over many decades. The US has always found a way to employ the financial and human capital invested in the IMF and World Bank for its own interests, and so will this administration. The IMF and World Bank provide the best prospects for the US to beat China at its own game, in a way that is financially more attractive for recipient countries, more transparent in how programs are designed and executed, and more effective and sustainable in its outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. You've succeeded in making what's a very complicated problem almost understandable for the rest of us. While we collect questions, I'd like to ask one of my own. You talked about the influence of China in all of this. Could you talk a little more about an organization like BRICS, the Brazil, Russian, India, China, etc.? What influence is that going to have on the international monetary system? I mean, are they going to build up a counter to the G20?
Yeah. I think the BRICS should best be understood as a diplomatic offensive by China and other countries with roots somewhere back in the non-aligned movement that many of you will still remember. And as of now, the BRICS have loose talks, but there is not yet a coordinated approach that could be compared to something like, say, the G7 or even multilateral institutions. Many of the BRICS countries have divergent interests in many areas, but they do not like the fact that the dollar is such a dominant currency and power in international economic relations. So there is a financial support mechanism that is headquartered in Shanghai, I believe. And there is a capacity to do some mutual loans among the BRICS. They're also trying to get new members to come in. They're expanding over time. But I would not at this point see them as capable of agreeing on anything that's close to, say, an IMF or a World Bank, and neither, I think, will their objective of competing with the dollar be successful as long as the renminbi itself remains closed and is not widely used for economic and financial transactions. So I would mainly see it as something that is a diplomatic offensive, a diplomatic voice in the world, but not yet of major geoeconomic relevance.
Something to keep an eye on, though. Let's stick with China for a second. China holds much of the U.S. debt. How important is this to leverage on U.S. Policymakers and the international?
Yeah, China has built up a large reserve a cushion with U.S. treasuries resulting from lots of export surpluses over time. Lately, the reserves have not gone so much into treasury bonds. There's some very good work of how China has used its dollar incomes, dollar revenues, to support other ways of its geopolitical objectives. For example, by putting it into the BRI, or running other state-aligned institutions that use dollar for other purposes. It's no longer just in treasury instruments. But having said that, of course, China is still a very, very significant holder of treasury securities. But that cuts both ways. I mean, it's been a beneficial arrangement for both countries over a long time. And unwinding that would be a problem for the treasury market, of course, but it would also lead to large financial losses in China. And that's not something you want to see in your reserve portfolio. So that's been a very stable relationship that I would anticipate would continue for quite a bit longer.
That's a couple that are different aspects of the same problem, but let me ask a couple of them. What's the default rate on IMF and World Bank loans? Is it high? Is it?
No, it's very low. The IMF and World Bank don't take collateral for their loans, right? I mean, for example, a Chinese loan would sometimes involve rights to certain mineral exports, and it would all be run within China. The revenues and benefits would accrue in China, and the country would only get it back after the debt would have been served. These kind of things the IMF and World Bank don't do. The collateral, if you want, the reassurance that countries repay the IMF and World Bank, which operate both very much in tandem sometimes, is the quality of the loans, and more precisely, the so-called conditionality that I mentioned earlier. So every country gets an IMF loan against a certain set of conditions that are intended to ensure that the country is in a position to repay the IMF. For example, if the debt burden of a country is too high, a fund team will come and say, well, unfortunately, we cannot lend to you until you reduce your debt by a certain percentage. And then the country needs to turn to its private creditors and sometimes the official creditors and say, look, we need this loan, we cannot repay you, but if you agree to a restructuring, the IMF will come in and then we can pay you, maybe not on everything, but on a good deal of your burden. Sounds like a Chapter 11 process to me. So in this game, the IMF and World Bank used to work through the Paris Club that I mentioned. And that was a very efficient mechanism to sort out these debt issues. And then once the IMF comes in, the country indeed is able to repay its loans. Now, there have been some instances where countries have been in so-called arrears to the IMF and World Bank. I think the longest has been, if I'm not wrong, Zimbabwe for something like 10, 11 years. That cuts the country off from all other lending by official institutions and usually also the private sector. And while that loan is outstanding, there are negotiations in play to eventually bring the country back. And in the few cases where countries have really, in a way, defaulted or run up arrears with the IMF, the process has led to the repayment down the road, and the IMF didn't have to write off anything as an institution. There has been a debt relief effort in the 2000s where richer countries provided poorer countries with the means to repay the IMF. But the two institutions have not really lost any money in that sense, which I think is the question. That's why I was saying earlier, the budgetary cost of IMF contributions are really low, because the two institutions are on top of the food chain of creditors, and every investment that countries put into the IMF and World Bank is pretty secure because of their role in the debt restructuring process. So it's a pretty sound investment. It's been a pretty sound investment over the last 80 years.
Well, this is a bit related, but someone wants to know, why has the IMF focused so much on Argentina? 25 bailouts in 50 years.
Yes.
Can you over-focus on one country?
Well, the IMF doesn't go to countries and say, hey, you want a loan? It's usually the other way around. And whoever has followed the long history of Argentina realizes that that country has kind of come on hard times after having been one of the richest countries around the turn of the century and even after the Second World War. They've had some pretty bad political choices, and then once the IMF came in and conditions were to be observed, that didn't go down so well politically, and unfortunately, especially after the 2000 programs, that went really badly because the country couldn't really reform its domestic economy. There was like a 20-year break before Argentina decided to come back to the IMF in 2018. And the reform efforts were too tepid at first. Then the government was voted out of office again. In came another government that was very free spending, relatively speaking. And now we've had a very extreme kind of fiscal adjustment that has been met with considerable success over the last year. And now they're back, they got a new program. They're not out of the woods, but with the floating currency and hopefully responsible macroeconomic management, they have a real chance of turning things around for good now. So yes, it's been one of the largest and most persistent borrowers, but also it's because, as I said in my remarks, Argentina is not covered by anybody else, like some other emerging markets. There is no swap line with the Fed. There is no EU rescue umbrella. There is no currency arrangement that's big enough to cover Argentina. It's only the IMF and to some extent World Bank and multilateral development banks. So being such a big country with large financing needs, dependent on the multilateral organizations, it's not a surprise if the programs don't really work that they have to come over and over again.
There's an awful lot of questions here about the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and a couple of them in particular, on whether we ought to revisit the idea of the neutral Bancor currency, or is it too late for that?
Yeah, I'm afraid. It was probably a great idea, but not with much prospects for success even back then. But you see, the problem is, and it's always been like that. Where I come from, my country, Germany, where we came here from 30 years ago, it's been having a great run with its car industries, chemical exports, the huge trade surplus. It's been exporting left, right, and center, and the whole fabric of the country is geared toward exporting stuff. Japan, similar. China, well, same thing now, that with the domestic economy in trouble, The government has said we need to export more. So for these countries, it's very, very hard to change the focus by, say, investing more, fostering domestic consumption, letting the exchange rate appreciate to balance their economy. And they don't have to, because they are not in any way running out of room for their economic model. The reserves come in. And all they have to make sure is that they're not running up, say, inflation domestically because of all the demand for export goods. So any politician who would say, well, maybe we should really not have this big trade surplus, maybe we should not export so much more, or maybe we should just gear up domestic spending to have a bit more higher inflation, will be voted out of office, because people will say, well, actually, it's just going great, why change it? On the deficit side, you always have to worry that, well, we're importing so much, but where do our foreign exchange reserves come from? We are not exporting enough. So when things go really bad, the adjustment will be forced on a country. So that's where this imbalance come in. The Bancor was a great idea, but assuming that the countries of the day, including the US, which was an export nation back then after the war, would really kind of voluntarily agree to that and have the political support from their countries to sustain it, most likely unrealistic. So sometimes economists have great ideas, but they're not going to be implemented. So it's not the first time that you would hear that, presumably.
Well, there's a couple of questions here people ask about the effect of corruption. How does the IMS world handle pressing needs of developing countries where there's a high level of corruption? Is that taken into account?
Yeah. In my active days, I think 2017, 18, 19, there was a whole work stream at the IMF think how the IMF could lend while helping countries push back on corruption, money laundering, and all that. It all ran under the heading of governance reforms. And I think together with the British government at the time that led a major global effort, there was a new policy that got installed. It was, for example, a major effort in the 2015 Ukraine program that the fund would say, well, unless you have really governance reforms, independent prosecutors and the like, we're not going to lend to you. But you also have to understand that the IMF doesn't really have a large presence in a country, so it can insist on certain legislation, but it cannot, by means of its small resources, go there and check every single loan that a country does internally, whether it's all done properly or not. It has to rely on other organizations. It has to rely on the World Bank and the like. So it's important to kind of set the framework right and to have the legislation in place. But in many countries where the legislation is not always properly enforced, it's like an uphill battle that takes a long time to really improve things. But the effort has been there. It would require constant efforts. And I think the large countries also would need to kind of lead by example on that to get to real big improvements.
And there are several questions here on what impact various things will have on international monetary exchange. One is, what is the impact of Bitcoin going to have on this whole situation?
Bitcoin is an interesting mechanism. It comes out, of course, of the idea that the very libertarian idea of not having to rely on any government-issued mechanism, as money is one, to do commercial and private and other financial transactions. It is a very stable mechanism. At some point, it was intended to be something like gold in the digital sphere. But it turns out that it's not really kind of lending itself easily to do this kind of financial transactions that you would just use a credit card, for example. Bitcoin is a bit more complicated, as we all know. It's also very energy intensive. So it has this claim to be a bit of an alternative reserve asset. But the reality is that it's been going up and down in price pretty much along with, for example, the stock market. And it's had its highs and lows. It's not something the IMF would have recommended to be used in international finance. In fact, El Salvador had to commit to abandoning it as an official means of payment in exchange for an IMF program, because otherwise the central bank is really not in a position to fully control money supply and fulfill program conditions. And so it's continued to gain a lot of interest along with other cryptocurrencies. But there's a lot of questions that have occurred, for example, when the Federal Reserve didn't exist yet and you had independent supplies of money across different states here in the US. Different banks would issue their own money. And it turned out that actually a centrally organized and well-managed money supply is actually beneficial because of its stability and reliability. So we'll have to see whether Bitcoin and crypto will ever get to a point where there is trust that the supply and the management of these currencies, these cryptocurrencies, is stable enough to really further economic well-being and facilitate transactions. I don't think we're there yet. I know that it's being pursued, but it's still a long way to go, I think, if ever we get to that point.
A couple more I think we have time for. What do you think about the U.S. debt situation?
The
U.S. debt situation.
It's on a trajectory that's worrisome. It's driven to a large extent by entitlement programs, as I think we called it at some point. So healthcare spending, the largest in terms of public healthcare spending relative to other industrial countries, with unfortunately not so great outcomes in terms of life expectancy and all that. There's Social Security, which is important. That's a parametric question that you can, if necessary, adjust somewhat by raising contributions, lowering benefits, later retirement age, all these terrible things. But healthcare is really the biggest problem, because how can a government take back healthcare benefits politically? And, you know, as an economist, one is always hard-headed and said, well, you know, something has to give, but politically it's a huge problem. And then, as we now know and we observe it, if there are questions about the value of the dollar, about its role in the future, interest rates in the US tend to go up. And that's the other big dynamic that is worrisome, because interest payments take up a bigger and bigger portion of the budget. So the amount that's left after you also have to spend a big chunk on defense, given the foreign obligations that the US has and the rivalries that exist, there's less and less left. And that makes it really difficult to cut the deficit. Now, the US has still time to fix problems. I mean, we rang the alarm bell, I myself, when I was on the team that covered the US almost 20 years ago now, that said exactly that. Healthcare benefits, yada, yada, yada. But the US has been able to just finance itself relatively easily over all those years, even with a little crisis in between that was really tough to overcome. So there's a lot of confidence in the United States economy and in the dollar as such. Also, by comparison with other countries like Japan or so, the debt burden of the US isn't that large yet. Talking about 100% of GDP, give or take. But the trajectory is not good. So something has to change. And the point where something has to change comes ever closer. And it's certainly been accelerated by developments that make people question whether US treasuries are a safe investment. So policymakers here in the US need to be careful about not just the long-term trajectory, but also more the medium term.
I think maybe we'll end it with that. And thank you very much. Really much appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.